In association with Newsarama, welcome again to Word Balloon. This is John Suntress. Today on the Comic Book Conversation Show, we're talking to writer Jeff Parker, who has a lot of irons in the fire. Plenty at Marvel when you consider Agents of Atlas, the great book that puts together the 1950s Avengers in modern times, facing the dark reign of Norman Osborn. Jeff's also taken over the book Exiles, the X-Men parallel universe group that goes around from Earth to Earth, facing alternate versions of heroes and villains in worlds you can't possibly predict. He's just started his 5-issue miniseries about the Hood, one of the cabal of Norman Osborn's dark reign in Marvel Comics. And from Wildstorm, a great miniseries he's wrapping up with Tom Fowler, Mysterious, the Unfathomable. We'll talk about all those books and his artists and get some questions from some Word Balloon listeners, all coming up on this episode of Word Balloon. Now, this was done in two parts and was done at the beginning of May and at the end of May. So you're going to hear a lot about Agents of Atlas, both the issues 5 and 6. And I go from not reading Exiles to having read issue 1. And we get good background on those series. But I've been following Mysterious from the start, and there's a lot of good talk about that. And we discuss issue 1 of The Hood. So really neat stuff. But you'll notice a time jump about an hour into the program, and I just wanted to explain things. Without further ado, here's Jeff Parker on Word Balloon. Well, let's start with Agent of Atlas, because actually, I know Mysterious and Agents of Atlas came out yesterday as we're recording, and enjoyed them both and currently love reading both of them. But start with Atlas, because I'm...
Because that's the one people have actually read.
No,
let's
man.
Talk about that.
Oh, no, you know, we'll get to Mysterious, but I got to tell you, I've heard a lot of good podcast buzz, and and so some people are reading Mysterious, I'm happy to say. So we'll,
yes, so, discerning people, they are. The good people, the ones we love. But no, it's like, yeah, we can get back to that. I'll get on that list since that's fresh on everybody's mind.
Well, yeah, because they just fought the new Avengers.
Yeah.
And that was very interesting. And also, I love the interaction with Bucky and the way you tied in the flashbacks with Bucky, too. That was a lot of fun.
I was kind of surprised, yeah. And I was kind of surprised on the Wolverine thing. People,
absolutely.
I always think people are going to just see everything I'm doing coming. And then when they don't, I'm just like, wow, cool. It's like I wasn't really counting on that to be a major surprise or anything. But then it's kind of nice when people are just kind of blindsided by something.
It was the furthest thing from my mind when I was reading it, too. And it was funny. And it's like, oh, yeah, of course. That was great.
It's so fun to use the M11, the human robot, like that. Because he's just always there. No one's thinking about him. He's not saying anything. But he's always thinking. And it's like you always have to. Everyone forgets about him because he's not saying anything, and then he does something, and then it always throws everything into chaos, or fixes things, or whatever. But it's just—it's always something that, in retrospect, you can go back and see why he was thinking that. And I love having a character that I can do that with.
Do you ever see a time where we might see an issue from his perspective?
Yes, actually, I've thought about that, or definitely at least doing one that just. Where he kind of goes off on his own and does his thing, which I kind of imagine like the Frankenstein monster walking around, getting on a seesaw with the kid. Oh, wait, I'm running young Frankenstein in there, aren't I?
That's right. I think the original one, they're throwing flowers in the water.
I'm picturing Gene Hackman with his cigars and everything. I love that so much.
Or Tobor the Great, if you know your old black and whites. Remember
that
movie?
Oh, man. As a kid, I loved Tobor.
Who didn't love Tobor? Seriously, that's for people listening, if you don't know that film, look for it. Tobor the Great. Classic.
It makes you feel smart as a little kid because you figure out that it's robot backwards first, and then you go. In fact, that's the hold all of DC Comics had on me as a kid. And really old Atlas era stories, like things Marvel Boy would be in.
Absolutely.
You'd always get to the last panel and you'd go, and Mr. Live is evil, because that's what it is backwards. Wham! Like that was the big clue. I swear to God I'm going to do that in a comic one day and just have them turn around and say that to everybody and see if they don't run me out of the industry.
Well, I think people like the humor that you're putting in Agents of Atlas. The recap page, thank God, someone has finally done something creative with the recap page.
I don't see why people don't have more fun with it. And really, a lot of that is due to the assistant editors. The king of the recap page, everyone at Marvel will admit, is Nate Cosby. He's the one that came up with the brilliant distillation of Spider-Man's life with that little Colleen Coover cartoon of Spider-Man. Got bit, uncle died, fight crime. And... It's like, yep, that's all you need to know, and now you're off. And So he kind of started all those fun recaps in recent years, and now, like, on the recap page, a lot of times Lauren Sankovich, who's our editor on Atlas, will put it together. On Exiles, Jordan White will put them together.
Very cool.
Or whatever, and they're all really getting into it. And at first I was doing it, and now it's like, okay, once in a while I'll still write it, but it's like, okay, you guys don't get to write these characters. I'll let you do it.
Well, that's really cool.
I get all the fun.
Yeah, well, and it's definitely in their voice so far. I mean, you know, five issues in.
Yeah, I feel predictable. It's like, oh, you totally nailed me there. But it is it's a fun way because it actually draws your attention. It's the kind of thing people will ignore, and then they'll complain that, how am I supposed to pick up where this is coming from? There's nothing like, well, that recap page actually told you everything you needed to know.
I also like how the team individually matched up with the new Avengers. And, you know, that's something I didn't even consider, but it was fun watching Ronan and Jimmy Woo fight each other, and certainly Ms. Marvel and Namora.
Well, yeah, that's of course, the fun one. I was like wanting to get, oh, this is such a perfect lineup. I could really just have these two women fight all day.
And, man, Venus only continues to get more beautiful with each issue.
Oh, Carlo Pagliaro can just draw the hell out of her.
He sure can.
He is no slouch at drawing her. It's incredible, and that's something you can't just hand off to anybody, because she's supposed to be that beautiful and that attractive, or her character doesn't work. It's not like a typical, here's a Frank Cho pretty girl or whatever. It's like, they, you know, they're all hot or whatever. She has to have that, just that little bit edge on everybody else, and you can't have Namora not looking good. So it's just like he just has to somewhere find it in him to make her look even better.
Well, and who drew her for the, I'm looking at the recap page right now on issue 5. Is that somebody different that drew that?
I believe that's, I don't have it in front of me, but I'm pretty sure that's one from one of the Ed McGuinness variants. I really like the way Ed drew Namora on her variant cover. I thought he did one of the best Namoras I've ever seen.
Was that for the original miniseries, or?
No, these are all for this one.
Okay.
They've all been used on variants.
That's cool. You see,
you probably got the Billy Tan cover.
I do have the Billy Tan covers.
And I don't remember what the variant. I think Venus might be the variant on this one. She's certainly more important than everybody else because she's the only one who can come in and stop it. They're pretty much counting on her, because otherwise they have to actually really fight to win. And they are fighting as hard as they can, but, you know, they don't actually want to hurt them.
Well,
that's the nice thing with superheroes. They can take a punch.
So is the story shifting focus then now? Because, I mean, I'm looking forward to issue 6. We've got Namora coming face-to-face with Namor and his involvement on the Cabal. So are we done with the new Avengers for now, or, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
As far as the new Avengers are concerned, they won, you know.
Sure, yeah, they stopped
the shipping. They got the same treatment everybody is always used to get from the Yellow Claw. There, we beat you, and you had to teleport away because we won. And so there, and we got to see the ship go down. And it was sort of the thing where, you know, it's like, at least it leaves them feeling good, because, you know, ever since Norman Osborn's taking control, they've just been running into one brick wall after another. And it's the same thing has happened to Atlas that's happening to everybody. And I think, I'm trying to remember now, I think Bendis was the one who verbalized it originally. It's like, everybody's going to find out what it's like to be Peter Parker for a while.
Sure.
And it's like, hey, this is Peter Parker's life. Even when you win, you lose, and you just... And I love that take on it. It's like, I don't hear people playing it up enough, but that's the way I saw it anyway.
And in the case of the Atlas group, they too have to kind of toe that line of obviously not succeeding enough. And it's going to be interesting to watch them walk that line with Osborn, obviously. And
yeah. The whole thing builds around the way Jimmy Woo thinks. And as far as he understands, just a year ago, he was still an FBI agent. So to him, it's just a huge FBI undercover sting, like he would run on anybody, like on Wise Guy, you know, where you get close to them by earning their trust. And they got just close enough where Osborn showed up to overlook the munitions operation. And while he's standing there looking at it, that's when Bob jumped into his head and got that little bit of information that Namor was connected. And you know, now we're on to issue 6. So let's go to that, because that's the way you do it. You don't call anybody. No, let's all get in the flying saucer and go under the ocean.
Before I forget, I want to...
No one uses phones in the Marvel Universe. You just show up.
before we talk more about it, possibly what's going to go on in issue six, I want to mention Gabe Hardman's great work doing the 1958 sequests.
Oh, yeah. Well, and Gabe Hardman is doing the whole Atlantean story, too.
Oh, wonderful. Very cool.
Yeah, so it's like he tweaked his style a little bit to just to make a noticeable shift into the modern day, and it's just beautiful stuff. There's really nothing that guy can't draw.
That's great.
And the only reason he's not doing, some stuff right after that is because he's, at the moment, storyboarding some film that Christopher Nolan's putting together. Because Gabe is like a really sought-after storyboard artist in Hollywood.
That's what I had heard, yeah.
That's where he makes his real money. I mean, they put us to shame. There's no getting around that. But also they burn you out because, you know, they want everything at the last minute and now. And, you know, I used to do storyboards for commercials and music videos and stuff. And all your jobs are always at the last minute. And you're always, you know, and you can't tell them to go F themselves because it just pays too much and you needed that money.
So sure.
You pretty much stay up all night and work on it. And all through the Namor story coming up, Gabe was doing the movie, and he would do that during the day because he'd have to go over to the studio and work on it. And then he'd come back at night and do the pages, and it's like, how is he doing this? It's like he's turning out just incredible art or whatever. It doesn't suffer at all. It's like, and we just felt bad. We were like, okay, after this, just let us know when you're done with that movie or whatever, and we'll send you a script then or whatever, because we don't want to be the ones responsible when you collapse. And, you know, so... He was kind of relieved, I think, to just switch back to one job for a minute.
I also hear that revisions is a big part of storyboarding, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's constantly
endless revisions. They don't want to bother to really think about it until you've drawn it. And then it's like, no, that's not the way I saw it. And really, they have almost no one ever bothered to think about it until you thought about it.
Jesus.
So, yeah, it is. It's part of why it pays well, at least.
Well, I understand that. Well, and
my massive ego just couldn't take it because I would board commercials and I would come up with all of these visuals, and then the director would say, "Yes, this works," and then they go off and get paid 10 times what I got, and I would just think, "Well, screw this! I ought to either direct or go back to comics where they actually print my name."
Well, and I'm hoping that some of these ideas are going to translate to eventual film or TV properties because I think you're a high concept guy. All your stuff does have interesting stories. When we get to Mysterious, you're obviously combining several of your favorite things in that book.
Oh yeah,
right. Well, now
I always think visually, and I always try to think what would be interesting to draw because I just don't want to stick the artist with here's a conversation.
Sure.
You know, there you can have a conversation, but be somewhere interesting or be fighting or. It's something that is worth drawing when you're doing it.
Is there a good group of Atlas Age characters that you can also refer back to? Because I like the time switching back and forth to, you know, the agents in the 50s and then, of course, the modern story today. I'm assuming you're going to do more of that.
Oh, yeah. I think it confused some people at first because we were putting the flashbacks right in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go back and read it now, you can probably see that I was doing it on purpose. For it wasn't arbitrary, and one of the things I wanted to get across, I thought it was important to remind everybody that this is a group from the 50s. You know, because otherwise, if you didn't read the first issue, I mean the first miniseries, you don't really get any. You wouldn't get any sense of that, except that they look a little archaic. And I thought, no, I want everybody to see how Marvel Boy used to be. The sun hero and everything, and so fresh faced, and how he is now, this kind of goth, creepy guy hanging out in the dark, breathing methane.
Yeah, spent a little too much time on Venus, obviously.
Yeah.
No, it's really fun watching Bob and seeing inside of his head, and all the changes that he's going through.
That's... Oh yeah, because in issue 4, you get to see how he sees himself.
Yes,
he's just this sort of half human, half Uranian giant amoeba thing. And it's like, yeah, it's always fun. It's like to go weird with him.
Well, and also just the fact that he's Bob, that also just kills me too, because he is this weird kind of space alien. Who's that? Oh, that's Bob.
spot.
You know, and just the nonchalant way that Bob and Ken, for that matter, are able to have these conversations. So you've got the half alien, half human, and the talking gorilla basically hanging out. I know that Marvel is going to start exploring the Golden Age more, certainly with the 70th anniversary going on.
Yeah, suddenly they're busting out the all-winter stuff and everything.
Yeah, that Human Torch thing, Chris Burnham and Tom DeFalco, really cool story. And, of course, the Marvel Age, you know, starts in the 60s, but you seem to kind of own this 50s decade. This is fertile ground for more stories, I'm assuming.
Oh, I think so. It's fairly easy to find that stuff. The reprints of it, anyway, because in the early 70s, which is when I first saw any of it, they were, you know, they'd reprint that stuff to fill up tons. They'd do Marvel Tales, and then you'd have Marvel Boy in there in the middle of a Spider-Man Human Torch thing, and then him, and it all went together well with me, and maybe that's why I can do this book at all now, is because, oh, well, I read all these things at the same time. They all made sense to me then. It's strange to me when people think it's like, oh, yeah. You know, you'll occasionally get some people online, not that I go read things online, but I've been told, you know, and people will say, like, well, they look ridiculous or whatever. I'm like, what is so ridiculous about the talking gorilla that isn't ridiculous about Thor or Spider-Man?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's like they all look the same to me. They're all running around with their underwear on the outside, jumping and flying and yelling things and saying wahoo,
sure,
or whatever.
No, I agree, man.
Everybody's got eye patches. It's strange, and I think that's what I think Colleen Coover and I came to a theory about that one day, because someone had interviewed her and was talking about, you know, she was mentioning all the stuff she grew up reading, and she mentioned she went into the Harvey comics and then some fantasy, like Archie's, and then Heroes and stuff like that. And I forgot who it was, but he said, wow, you're really eclectic there. And I'm like, no, I just read comics. And I think that's the way I was, too. I just read whatever comic was at my age level. I think a lot of people, or at least like a modern readers, only came into it during superheroes.
Yes.
So to them, it is a kind of narrow sort of thing. Kind of like I only listen to this one radio station.
Yeah.
Or something. Or whatever, which I can't identify with, because it's like, oh, well, I just read pretty much every comic that was around.
No, I did too, man.
Scott Staples, I'm going to read that.
Pretty much, exactly, whatever was on the spinner rack. And yeah, if, you know, Archie was as much of an option, or the Harvey books, like you say. The only one I couldn't read, honestly, of the Harvey books was Sad Sack. That was just too messy for me.
Oh, yeah, no, Sad Sack sucked. That's why you couldn't read it. There was nothing funny about Sad Sack.
There really wasn't.
That's why the beginning of Lost Boys is just complete BS. Because I don't know if you...
I don't remember. Did they have a mention of Sad Sack?
The first thing, in the opening scene of The Lost Boys, when they cut away from the kids after they just moved to the town, this girl's on a date in a convertible with her boyfriend. He's trying to kiss her on the neck and everything, and she's reading a Sad Sack comic book, laughing her ass off.
It's I had
like,
no idea.
No one ever laughed that hard reading Sad Sack comics.
You're here.
Because remember, they're in a comic book shop in part of the movie, too.
Well, yeah, the Frog Brothers, aren't they?
They run a comic shop.
Yeah.
Kids who run a comic shop, which, sadly, that part was true, because I remember several times going into comic shops that were run by kids.
You know, Jimmy Woo, he's still my favorite. I'm curious if, is his old body, is it in a coma? Is it dead? What is the status of old Jimmy Woo?
All of his cells are regenerated, so it's just his body.
Oh, okay. I thought this was... all right, because I misunderstood.
No, he didn't clone. I've seen people thinking that, too. It's like, no, he didn't clone him. He used his technology and whatever that weird little chemical bath was to just set him back to what his headband, which is, you know, supposed to be Eternals technology, so it's, you know, way advanced. And but he can't do it with almost anybody else because he didn't meet everybody else back then. No, he just regenerated his all of his cells.
I see. Okay.
Right there.
Very
cool. If some washed away in that chemical bath, then maybe they did, but yeah.
Okay.
I think we were talking about that at one point where I wanted to do a scene where they reclaimed some memories and you just hear Jimmy talking about being on a helicarrier chasing a giant green monster or whatever and just making a bleak reference to Godzilla.
You know, yeah, because unfortunately that's all you guys can do from a right standpoint.
I know, that's all you can do. In fact, I was just told today, and Bill Roseman wrote me and said, you got to take Dr. Demonicus out of this hood screen.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, because I keep trying to use his huge supporting cast of villains who are all part of his mob. And I just thought it would be fun to put Dr. Demonicus in there. And it's like suddenly legal said, oh, we can't use Demonicus anymore. Like, okay, Mr. Fear or the Grimm brothers look exactly like him, so that's easy. They fill the bill just fine. They do about the same thing.
Very cool. Do we see Nick Fury and the Secret Warriors maybe coming across the agents at some point?
That would be a very natural thing, I think. So, yeah, I'm going to talk to Hickman and Bendis about that.
There you go. Excellent.
Hey, shut us some of those readers of yours.
Well, no, that's the thing. I think both books are serving that itch of the old espionage and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, they get the espionage in there, and it's very clear that people are missing that. I guess it's like Thor, you know, you got to take it away for a while before people realize, hey, we would like that back.
Well, the focus of this team-up as opposed to others, there is more of a caper element because they do kind of have to come up with a scheme to, you know, impress Norman enough, but also foil him at the same time, and then run the risk of running into heroes, as opposed to heroes just going after whatever the bad guy of the month is.
Yeah, what I like is it kind of foregoes the whole Marvel heroes meet up confusion, they get in a fight, or whatever. Now it's just built in. It's like if they meet any heroes, they're almost obliged to get in a fight every single time. And that's why it was fun in number 5 when they meet the new Avengers to subvert it and have Spider-Man almost ruin the whole thing by catching on.
Yes.
And I haven't, you know, and I hope people will realize part of what I was doing there is I wanted to make a point that the thing that fools Norman Osborn, a.k.a. the Green Goblin, does not fool Spider-Man. And, you know, I don't know if anyone's going to really pick up on that, but I just thought it was a nice way to have him be the one. Because, you know, who else has beaten Norman Osborn more than anybody in the Marvel Universe?
Sure.
And it's like, yeah, so yeah, he's just that little bit cleverer than everybody else, even though no one gives him credit.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing.
He's Rodney Dangerfield, and he's not going to get credit or respect no matter what he does.
Well, and his intelligence is more off the cuff because he doesn't have the time to pursue whether it's the investigative smarts that he has or the science and everything, and that is, yeah, he's kind of like the savant, not a savant, but like a Mozart or whatever, who could just walk in and go, yeah, anybody think of this?
He's like one of your buddies that I'm sure you have who are, let's go on and talk about a book I don't write for a minute. But
sure.
Spider-Man's kind of like he's like one of your extremely smart buddies who for some reason works like a low-paying job. But, you know, he's always going to beat you when you play Trivial Pursuit or any other freaking game. Or whatever. He's good at everything else except his own life. And
yeah.
He just can't get that his stuff in order. He can't invest stocks. He can't find a way to be rich so that he can just pursue fighting crime all the time. The best thing he's been able to come up with is go work for the Avengers.
That's good.
Look, it's like everybody knows somebody like that.
Absolutely.
I hope our balloon listeners all learned a valuable lesson.
There you go. And digression.
You're all really smart, and you're not achieving anything. And I'm right there with you, so don't feel bad. I'm so smart, I'm going to write this comic.
No, hey, man, they are smart comics. That's the good news.
Well, I'm trying.
Well, but I I'm glad that companies are giving you the chance to experiment, and case in point, Mysterious the Unfathomable, because you and Tom Fowler are putting out a great book that more people should be reading, and it's a great combination of high adventure, a love of magic, and humor. And, I mean, as I was saying, these are three of your favorite things. I know this talking to you, and they're all in this one book, and I think it's a great presentation. It's a lot
oh,
of fun.
Thanks.
I really
well,
do.
Tom certainly, I mean, it's funny whenever we try to find, is anyone reading this book? No. But apparently French people will keep trying to find out about it, and I don't think they've got it over there yet, but they instantly respond to Tom's art, you know, because they're used to getting a lot of good art, like Juanjo Garnido does Black Side and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Yep.
And, you know, and Tom's art speaks to them, whereas people get confused over here because it looks kind of like Mad Magazine. Like, well, yeah, one of his biggest influences is Jack Davis.
Clearly so. And
even though I think he looks like Mort Drucker. To me,
But again, that's what's great. There's the satire that his art can carry as well as your words. He's a good storyteller. He does action well. He does humor well. You play with magic in the same way that I think good Whedonverse programs have as well. I mean, a lot of the...
Oh, good.
Yeah, I think a lot of the seances and stuff reminded me of, like, scenes from Angel, for example, you know, in a good way. So
I try to, with that sort of thing, I don't want it to be arbitrary. I try to figure out strict rules of how magic works in that world and then stick to them so that it's not just a plot device that pops up. And then walk the careful line of having Mysterious and Delphi. They, you know, they shouldn't be able to kick anyone's ass. I mean, they're just the weakest up against almost anybody. So they can't, they can only get out of things by being clever. You know, and I don't even like having them dumb luck out of it. It's like, no, she's pretty smart. She's actually very clever and smart. And he's been around a long time because he's stealing years off people's lives and staying along. He uses his little magic watch to kind of rob people of a year at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no one will ever miss it. I ran out of room. I really, on that one scene where he does that, where she makes him admit that he does that,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to just do the Francois Truffaut thing of cut to someone else in the world who's just dying on his deathbed. And like, if only he had lived another year, he would see his grandchild being born.
Oh, geez.
Because I always want to play up the not ever let anybody forget that Mysterious is a horrible person.
Absolutely.
And I really, it was very important to me that he be horrible. Because it doesn't matter whether they're a moral person or not. It matters if they're interesting and readable. And that's all I care about with him. He doesn't have to have a conscience. That's what she's for. And that's the important role that his assistant fills. And when he's got a real assistant, which he does again, you know, she steers him to so that he's just not a menace to the world. He actually performs a service in the end.
Absolutely. Some good can come out of, you know, his dickishness.
Yeah. It's like, and that's another thing. It's like you've also probably had to manipulate people to get what you want out of them, and that's just a fact of life with him. And it's actually not too hard with him. It's like he's kind of lazy, so he's not really going to fight you on anything. You just got to find a way to push his wants or fears, and he's technically a hero, in a way.
You know, I always feel bad when I say this because I don't mean to diminish the comic, but I could see this being a very cool television series.
Oh, there's no way I didn't think of that. It's like, you know, right off the bat, I thought this would be a great setup for TV. You know, we're co-owners of it with DC, so I certainly hope that we can get it into some other media. Because, I mean, I would love to see somebody like Jeffrey Rush playing him.
That's great.
Yeah, it's like, he didn't end up looking as much like him as it, and that was who I was trying to suggest Jeffrey Rush at the beginning, not so much for looks, but as the kind of character he plays so well, where this morally ambiguous, self-serving kind of guy that still you just can't take your eyes off of. And Rush does that really well. Hugh Laurie does it really well. Someone suggested somebody else the other day, and now I can't remember who it was, but...
Matt Feuer can do pretty much anything, but I could see Matt Feuer with the right wig kind of being...
Feuer could do it. Strangely, someone in a review suggested Bill Murray, and even though...
I could see Bill Murray doing that. That would be great.
Yeah, even though physically I didn't see that, it's like, yeah, oh yeah, Bill Murray could easily do that.
Oh yeah, like I think 21st century Bill Murray absolutely can do that. Yeah, he's aged that way, and I think his face has that interesting kind of weathered look that Fowler gives Mysterious as well.
That giant nose. He did.
Yeah.
And you're right. Have to put that giant nose on everybody.
The women, for example, in issue 5 look sexy, even though they are still kind of cartoony and everything. It's very, very cool. I really think it's a hell of a book. And yeah, honestly, if you like this combination of high adventure, humor, and magic, I think you really will enjoy the book. And it's sometimes the Vertigo vibe, and I love Vertigo, and I love what they do with magic, but sometimes it's a little too heavy all the time. So nice to have fun with magic and still tell interesting, exciting stories and action-adventure as well.
Yeah, it can get heavy and kind of twee, and...
yeah.
We don't mean to go broad. We're just trying to have a little more life into it than a lot of the stuff that that you kind of presuppose when you're thinking of that. And it's like, you know, I like magic stuff, and you know, but I don't get to use quite as much of it or Marvel as I probably would. Well, I say that, but now I'm doing this Hood miniseries. It's where the guy's running around with Dormammu in his body, so yeah, I can't really say that at all, I guess, so I should just shut up. But
okay, I'll edit that out. Don't worry.
It's like, yeah, I do use a lot of magic. I'm totally wrong. but up till now, I've had to do a lot of science-based stuff. Agents of Atlas, I get to use a mix of it, which because, you know, that's the whole thing. It's
Venus
multiple genres.
Well, that's true, yeah.
But yeah, it is fun to just get on Mysterious's world, and I hope to be able to do some more books with Tom, because on that, but on other things too. But because I really want to go back and do the thing like we do with Atlas and explore, like, okay, here's him in the 40s. We do a little bit of that throughout the miniseries, but it would be nice to open up and do an entire issue or so where you're just looking at him in the 50s and whatever. And then ultimately working way back to when he first gets his start as a stage magician.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, because I know going back to your escapist story that you did for Dark Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And
only read by you.
Those Cavalier and Clay, for people who don't know what I'm talking about, go back and check out some of those trades, because, you know, Michael Chabon's character, superhero that he created for that Adventures of Cavalier and Clay novel, a lot of creators like Jeff told some really, very, really cool stories. And the two trades that collect them are absolutely worth getting. But again, that's your love of stage magic. And that's what I was going to say. And that's what I like about this miniseries is, as much as he really is a real magician, there's time to poke fun at the various ages of stage magicians as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to keep myself out of any possible legal trouble, I won't mention any. But if you're paying attention, you can see we're making fun of some current performers.
I know.
It shouldn't be too hard to tell who's who, but you know, we're DC Legal, man. They just really everything possibly too close. You know, they're like, they're coming. You got to change this guy, and like, come on now. They do it so much, and it's like, don't you own Mad Magazine? It's like, can this not be satire?
That's a very good point.
And can't. Can we, instead of talking to you, can we talk to the lawyers who specifically work with MAD? Because that's what we're doing.
Now, in this current chapter of the miniseries for Mysterious, I like the nod to Wicker Man, of course.
Oh, yeah. There's a creepy reference. Well, yeah, and I was surprised as I was looking around on the internet and trying to see, like, okay, certainly somebody's done something about Burning Man being an enormous cult. And no, they hadn't. So I was like, okay, well, that's where I'm going.
That's outstanding.
Hey, my little boy just burst in. Steven, what are you doing? Everybody keeps asking me, like, are you reading your comics to them? And it's like, no, I don't think they get a lot out of it. But I do read stuff like Uncle Scrooge to them.
That's cool.
Because that's what I liked as a little kid. And, you know, it's like they go all over the world. They have big adventures. They're ducks. I mean, what's not to like?
Yeah, there's no downside there. Absolutely. Did the kids get free comic books from Free Comic Book Day?
Oh yes.
Excellent.
We definitely get the Owlies.
Very cool. Yeah, Owlies great.
Even though they still kind of make me work on that one. It's like, no, look, Andy Runton leaves out the words. You're supposed to figure out what's going on. It's pantomime, like Sergio Aragonés.
Sure.
I'm having to make up stuff on the spot at the end of the day, and I'm tired of making up the character dialogue, and I can't think of anything.
Nice.
So
yeah. Do you want to tease what else is coming up in Mysterious that we should watch out for?
I don't want to spoil the thing for
okay,
you.
Okay, man,
but,
no worries.
But did you get a chance to read this one this week?
Yes.
I forgot.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, as you saw, it ended on a real downer.
Yes.
I'm
leaving it oblique so people will pick it up, because
yeah,
you really can't jump.
Yeah,
you,
Delphi has realized that maybe being an assistant to somebody with no moral compass is not the smartest move she could have made, and especially when she's out there just baking in the heat, trapped in an enormous wicker man with a bunch of hippies dancing around outside. So, yeah, does that need any more selling? That pretty much ought to get them out there.
There you go. Well, and you can jump in on this issue. By all means, I suggest you do read the others. But if you want to jump in at the end of this, I think this two-part story will tell you what you need to know, and you'll still enjoy it.
Yeah, it's one of those things, too, where I just wanted to get, I think I said this early on, it's like, it's kind of part homage to Douglas Adams. You know, Tom and I are big Douglas Adams freaks, and we love Hitchhiker's Guide and the Dirk Gently novels. And I really wanted a Dirk Gently-esque sort of character. Dirk's a little nicer than Mysterious, but he's also kind of self-absorbed in that way. And it's, you know, it's Dirk Gently, Holistic Detective, are the books.
Oh, yeah.
And there's only two of them, but they're really good. And you know, Dirk is running around seeing clues in everything that seems completely disparate and unrelated. And Mysterious kind of does that in a way, too. You know, he seems to be fascinated with something that has no apparent connection to anything. But then later you see a kind of method to all the madness as it comes together. And what I wanted to do was the thing of weaving two storylines in and out until they join. And you know, the issue three, you got to see where they go to what is essentially a Dr. Seuss hell, where all these strange creatures that were summoned to Earth by this little man who was a prominent children's author, not unlike whoever I mentioned a second ago. And, you know, and that was, of course, fun, just watching Tom go nuts on that. And I can't think of anybody who could have hung with him on that.
That's very cool, man. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's just like turning in a bit. Okay, let's get somebody with an enormous imagination and the skill to back it up and just turn them loose and watch what they do. And then Tom's great because he constantly thinks of things in story. So he comes back and he's worked in way more things than I asked for. And then he explains it to you and he says, well, no, this character here has kind of got a little rivalry going on with this guy. And it's like, really? I didn't even have that in there. Okay, that works great. You know, it just adds extra levels to it.
I do hope you guys are able to either do more Mysterious or are able to work on something else because, yeah, you guys are a good team.
Yeah, well, we may. And actually, the only reason I'm really not mentioning it is because I never believe in any comics project until not even when I've turned it in and gotten paid, because I've still seen stuff end after I've gotten paid for a script.
Interesting. Yeah, I have a feeling there's a lot of unfinished projects that are in drawers where art's done, but unfortunately we never saw them.
I think everybody would be shocked to find out the things that it's like.
Well, every now and then, like a publisher like Tomorrow's will release something.
Oh, yeah, they find stuff like that all the time.
Yeah.
Like, look, here's three pages of this thing you always wish.
Exactly. Like, this Nick Fury Bucky team-up happened, and Walter Simonson drew it. Here it is. Here's a page. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Or with Jack Kirby, you see that stuff all the time.
Like The Prisoner. He and Gil Kane did adaptations of The Prisoner. And we've seen, you know, a page here and a page there, and it's like, yeah, never mind. We're not going to do it.
Yeah, we're not going. They didn't seem interested. And you're going, no! Can I go back in time and pay them to do this?
You know, I got a gold key issue of Secret Agent.
Where'd you find that?
At Dark Tower, the place that they record the Around Comics podcast.
Okay.
So, and I have to tell you, they the hosts of that show, big Mysterious fans as well.
Oh, bless them.
So, and I've heard it discussed on 11 O'Clock Comics, and there's a reason why we're all talking about it, guys. It's a very good book.
Thank you.
So,
I don't know why this just reminded me of it, because this just kicked in. Let me apologize for our last podcast, where instead of Al Feldstein, I said Bernie Krigstein.
Okay.
Two completely different human beings. Just both happen to have Steen in their names and work for EC Comics.
I was going to say, both EC artists, obviously.
I've always done that with those two, and I'll say one when I mean the other, and it just drives me nuts later.
What was it in context to?
I was talking about Al Feldstein
creating the Yellow Claw.
Wrote the original Yellow Claw book, and it's like Al Feldstein created Jimmy Woo, but instead I was saying Bernie Krigstein.
Oh.
And then of course I'm going on to talk about he was just at Comic Con. I could have taken my book out and like, no, he's been dead 20 years. He was not there. And I'm like, it's like, oh well.
I keep trying to get Al Feldstein to come on my show, and I send him email requests, and I think I'm just going to have to find him at a, you know, hopefully see him at a show to hopefully eventually book him.
Yeah, you'll probably just have to go there and just
fly out.
Do it right then if he's feeling up to it.
Yeah. Parker, where are your questions? I know people have asked you, have had questions for you. They're at my website. Where the hell is that?
Oh, the answers are sure. And,
once, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I do, actually. I'm trying to find them right now. I thought they were on the front page. Where the hell is it now?
You and Bendis have those sweet threads that show your tweets.
Didn't you?
Problem is, I'm not going to bug anybody about that until I post more on there. It's like I always think, I want to go on here because I actually get a lot of reading enjoyment out of that board. But then I don't post. Because I guess I spend a lot of time reading, and then I better get back to work. there's a funny bunch of posters on there. They come up with great stuff.
Are you saying Twitter, or are you saying the Bendis board?
Oh, I'm talking about the Bendis board.
Okay.
Twitter I do, because, yes, it's very fast. I can just throw something out. And I'm afraid it's cut into my own blog posting time, though, because I feel like I've blogged, and really I haven't. I just...
Micro-blogged.
Micro-blogged, and that's not quite as substantial.
Well, to be honest, I like writing in short bites, so yeah, I think Twitter's perfect for me.
Yeah, I like it a lot too.
I have them here. We were talking about various questions, and
speaking of Twitter, it's Parker Space.
Exactly, Parker Space is where you can follow Jeff on Twitter. Yeah. I've got a thread that we started here at Jinx World of questions from some of the Word Balloon listeners that had questions for Jeff, so I want to get into these. And a lot of them are about Exiles, and that's good because the X-Men are my blind spot, and I'm very happy for you that you're on an X book, and I know that's always good news.
That means I'll just warp your knowledge of the X-Men by bringing you all these alternate versions that don't actually line up to... Well, they're not too far apart, though.
Jester from O-Town, Kentucky. That was his question, if Blink was the same Blink that had been leading the previous incarnation.
It is.
And he also wants to know that Morph was in the first issue. Any chance we'll see other old-school Exiles?
There's a very good chance, but it'll take a little while. So just stick with it. But yes, you will.
Orin Lupin, he wants to know how Agents of Atlas came about. Did you go to Marvel or what? So you can give the strange origin of Agent of Atlas for people who don't know.
The original story, the characters were first thrown together as a team in an old issue of What If from the 70s. That was what if there were an earlier set of Avengers in the 50s, and so then you see all the characters on that, and that was written by Don Glut, and that was under when Roy Thomas was editing, and it was just this one shot thing from that only John Suntries remembered, and my editor Mark Panicia was going through old Marvel comics. Just looking for something to revive, you know, specifically thinking, what's something that no one's touching and that might be really cool? And then he came upon that, and for some reason he thought of me, and then he emailed me and said, what do you think of this? And I said, I remember that. I read that. And then I went out and got the book again because I don't know where my original copy was, but I went to Excalibur Comics, I think, here in Portland and read it, and it's like, it's got a gorilla, it's got a robot, spaceman. Oh, yeah, this has everything you need to make an awesome comic book. Venus.
Secret Agent?
Yeah, it's got a secret agent. The only thing it had in it I didn't like was 3D Man. And but then, of course, in the story you see that Namora is the one who goes and helps them bring up M11.
Yes.
Who didn't have a name at the time. He was just the human robot.
Presumably,
because Stan Lee couldn't remember what an android was called, so he called it a human robot.
Well, I've heard Don Glut talk about how he cherry-picked all those characters from the various 50s books, but go ahead.
Yeah, and they put Jana the Jungle.
She had a little cameo, absolutely.
She's the one that leads them to Gorilla Man, who actually, when they in the original story, he's not doing very well against some lions who are attacking. So I don't know why they thought, we need this gorilla that can't beat up two lions. This is what we want. It's like, no, why didn't you recruit those lions? But whatever.
Well, you made them tougher.
They kind of play fast and loose on those early What Ifs. And, I toughened them up quite a bit. And actually, you got toughened up without me. They brought him in right before we did that. Keith Giffen wrote this thing. It's a great joke and concept. The Howling Commandos, but with all monsters. So
yes.
they use Fin Fang Foom as their jet and things like that. And and they had Gorilla Man in that.
Yes.
Which I used in the series because it established Gorilla Man as a member of S.H.I.E.L.D. And it's like, oh, good. Well, I can totally use that. Now, he and Jimmy have this inherent connection right
Absolutely.
Here in addition to that. And, yeah, the only thing I changed besides, well, the entire origin, the only thing I changed of the lineup was it's like that since they had Nomura in the story, I was like, no, wait, if you had Nomura in here, this would really work. It's like a 3D man, I don't know what his lame thing is.
He's like a poor man's Captain America. He was.
Yeah,
he had
really
the strength of and speed
Captain
of.
America.
I have the strength and speed of three men. It's perfect.
I can take naps three times as long as everybody else. It's one of those things you can't quantify. Everything's three times whatever. And but like, man, forget him. And plus, he wasn't an original character. It was the main thing. It's
right.
Like, you know, it's like okay, he was only made up in the 70s. It was kind of Roy Thomas's pet project, keep sticking in things. If you're reading Marvel Premiere or Triple Action or something like that. And so anyway, I took him out, put Nomura in. And, well, then I went and tracked down the comics, like, where's the last appearance of her? What did they do to her? Is there a way I can conceivably bring her back? And then you find her, she's just frozen in ice. I went, oh, my God. What? You couldn't have handed it better to me.
Exactly. She's waiting for you.
Yeah, it's just like, thank you, Bill Everett, for all the things you ever did, but then this. You know, it's like, that guy was great.
Very cool.
And it was very obvious. And then Roy Thomas himself said in Alter Ego that he originally was going to bring her back. And of course, he went downhill and died at the time. So it was a nice thing to be able to bring somebody back that was actually meant to be brought back. That you don't always get to do that. Usually you're bringing back somebody like Elektra that no one meant to bring back, you know.
Well, and I want to take a moment and talk about Nomura, because I like the fact that she sees more honor in or maybe she doesn't. I don't want to – actually, I shouldn't presuppose what might be coming in issue six, but this contrast of, you know, it'll be interesting to see how she takes Namor, and I don't want you to tip it necessarily because I want to read it as well, as mm-hmm. far as, you know, what her take is going to be, that her, you know, her cousin would kind of turn against – a cause that she sees where she's on the right side. So that'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yes, it's there's a conflict ready to go when they get there. But then, John, it has sexy results. Sorry.
Is that legal in Atlantis? All right.
Well, you're going to see. Like, everybody's like, oh, wait a second. Because, you know, we had that scene in the next to last issue of the original Agents of Atlas miniseries where Venus stops the group from fighting by just cutting loose with just full power, and everybody gets caught up in their own little love fantasy there. and of course I said to Leonard, it's like, draw him like Namor. It's like, come on now, no one else knows any other Atlanteans. It's like, who else is going to matter?
That's hilarious.
But then you're gonna find out that there's more to that, and.
But anyway, yeah. So the miniseries
so anyway,
did well.
Anyway, really, it's all the answer is Mark Fenicia had the idea.
Okay.
That they should exist again, and asked me how I would do it, and then I came back with pretty much very close to what you got, and he just went and pushed and pushed and pushed, and it was not an easy sell because, you know, it's the market's been in lean years, and everybody's like, no, we got to do it safe. Can we just have Wolverine and a clone of Wolverine and a future Wolverine all on a team together? Marvel was quite nice in approving this and giving me a pat on the back and wishing me good luck.
I'm glad that the series sold well enough for them to do the hardcover. I'm glad the hardcover sold well enough for eventually the series to happen. I mean, I know that there's a very strong cult following of people that really enjoyed this book, and it seemed more and more people were catching wind about it and enjoying it. If not in the miniseries, they were able to read the hardcover, for example. Mm-hmm. So, no, I'm glad, man. And I know in my own stores that I hang out with and stuff, I mean, I went from me being one of the few people because I enjoyed that What If issue so many years ago. but I'm like, this is a great book, and word got around, and it's like, yeah, this really is a good book. And I'm like, there you go.
Yeah, hopefully people will just keep, you know, I do fear the whole thing, like with Captain Britain, where, you know, now Captain Britain's coming to an end.
Yeah.
And I don't think it would have ended that soon if there hadn't been the false rumor a few months ago about it ending. And then that got out, and then everybody's talking, oh, Captain Britain's going down. I'm not getting on this. As if for some reason it doesn't count if you read something entertaining, which I just don't understand that mindset at all.
Well, and I, you know, luckily neither company is going to leave you hanging, and they're going to let you finish your story. I mean, that's the important thing. So I can appreciate it from a television standpoint when you never do kind of get closure on something.
Oh yeah, they'll just end it without so much as a snow globe episode to explain it all. You know, it's Marvel's being really cool, letting them wrap up and everything.
But that's a, you're right, that's a shame, because it's a great book.
Yeah, no, it's just, come on, people, it's like, you know, maybe it would have sold better if they called it Excalibur or something, or, you know, or just kept it with that, but I don't know. If I don't want to hear people complain about there not being enough variety when they won't support that variety.
Hear, hear.
It's, you know, it's, and there's no reason Captain Britain should be canceling, and don't, and now, so what I'm saying is, don't pull a Captain Britain on us, don't start, you know, circulating rumors that we're doing badly when we're actually not, but then that creates the self-fulfilling prophecy where you do badly, and then you end up getting canceled.
No, I understand. Well, it's
all because somebody wanted to be the first on the internet to proclaim something.
I hope that the Dark Reign tie-in helps, and again, you are definitely, you know, keying the story in to the big bad and finding a very good, solid line between the agents and Norman. And
it fits pretty well. It's a But I do hope people will get on, since we're obviously not going to do Dark Reign forever, I'm hoping that we're winning over some of the people who just come for the Green Goblin, stay for the Ape, or that sort of thing, or whatever, because we've got a lot of good stuff coming up. And for whatever reason, we're getting just top-notch artists after top-notch artists coming in, and they just really get into it, everybody, I think, because it's something different. So it's just like, I mean, The issue you saw yesterday with Carlo, it's like, I mean, that guy's just amazing.
Brown Bear asks, with all the books you write, do you keep notepads handy? Can you work on a multitude of books or multiple books at the same time, or do you have to work on them weeks apart?
It sounds like it'd be a good idea to just write some back-to-back. And like I did that last week, I wrote Hood number 4, and then I immediately wrote Hood number 5 while it was all fresh in my mind. So I try to do that when I can, but the truth is I generally always have to feed an artist. It's a, you know, it's like someone's about to run out of script, so now I've got to stop and write Exiles as soon as I get done with this issue of Atlas. So I often do flip around, but really the way it always works is I write whatever's coming to me, whether that's what's due now at the moment or not, because I have that fear of killing the muse. So, you know, if something's coming to me, it's like, I can't, no, I'll get back to you later. I've got to figure out what's going on in X-Men First Class. It's like, I don't have a choice. I need to just write this while it's also fresh. It's just going to go a lot better if I write it right now. But I do get little bits, you know, and all the stuff will come to me in the middle of something else. And to answer his question, yeah, I don't keep notepads, but I usually keep a little blank document open on my computer that I jump over into and write down things really fast. Because, you know, you'll get that thing where you're laying in bed and something will come to you, and you're sure you'll remember it in the morning, but you won't. And I'll roll over. I keep my computer next to the bed. I'll flip it open. I'll type some garble or whatever. And then in the morning, you're like, oh, yeah, okay, now I remember. And I know what I would have totally lost it if I hadn't done that.
All right.
So yes is the answer, I guess.
Okay.
That I made as long and painful as possible.
No, not at all. The Mandarin from Thibodeau, Louisiana. Do you watch and read a lot of 30s stuff? I see a lot of old pulp influence in your stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. It's gosh, I've read those old Doc Savage books. And, favorite all-time movie is still King Kong, the original. Even though I really like the remake by Peter Jackson. But, you know, that kind of stuff is just so burned into me. I don't even ever have to read or look at any of it again. I can just spit it right out. I absorb it so much early on. And I like old stuff like, if you ever saw the movie Lost Horizon.
Absolutely, love that movie.
That was terrific, even though you got to watch the print that just suddenly stops and they show you stills while you hear the dialogue for a little bit, and then it goes back into the movie because they lost whatever that section of the print
was. Yeah, they made them edit it years ago, and look, you know, they had to go to stills to kind of put together as close of a real cut that Capra originally had.
It's on some part where you're just looking at this frozen image of Edward Everett Horton.
Yes. Because only, like you said, the soundtrack's the only thing that survives. So yeah, they got to kind of.
Well, everybody's going Shangri-La, the mysterious Shangri-La, and you know, and all that stuff like the shadow and everything. I mean, it's how can you not dwell on that? There's no way. Even though I make a point of saying Agents of Atlas is modern pulp, really all comics are.
Of course.
They're all straight from the pulps, as sure as if that was their father or grandfather. And yeah, you might as well just cut right back into that stuff. You know, go read some old Cthulhu stories or something like that.
Yeah, or The Shadow or Doc Savage. I mean, you know, some of the, depending on who's writing it and everything, or even Robert Howard's stuff. My God, all the pulp stuff that Robert Howard wrote.
Definitely Robert Howard. So. Radio shows, they're very inspiring. And
Absolutely.
That's so nice because you can find those on the internet so easily now.
For free. Don't waste your money on the CDs, kids. You can find them for free. And it's
all.
Totally
for free and put it on your iPod or whatever John uses instead of an iPod.
There you go.
Yeah, it's
my Samsung MP3 player. But
I would love to do a thing like where you did a radio show of Atlas or, you know, some other. But Mysterious would be a good one for it too. You know, you could do it.
Oh, like Shandu the Magician, absolutely, man.
Exactly. Go do a radio drama.
Mysterious, the unknown.
But when people know, you know, when people rag on the fact that when they go off about commercials all the time, it's like, you know what? It's not as bad as it was if you were listening to in the 1930s and 40s to the radio. I swear to God, they couldn't get 2 minutes through a show. They didn't stop and talk about these cigarettes or this soap.
Yeah, yeah. Or in the comedy shows, we weave them into jokes and stuff. And you know, I got.
Well, that's better. It works better in the comedy shows than it does when Terry and the Pirates suddenly stop and start talking about
Wheaties.
Are you guys trapped in this pit? Are you just suddenly we're just casually talking about? Hey, Terry, the Timex watches are the best. And they. They just completely blow the suspension of disbelief.
I can't listen to those old kids' serials like that. Superman's the only one.
It's driving
me
nuts. It's like, God, it's all commercials.
That's awesome.
And then it's an organ. It's always an organ.
Yes, well, yeah, that was the cheapest instrument, so that could handle all the music.
Yeah, the one thing one person could handle. They didn't have to get a bunch of people in there.
I think Mutual Radio, they were the ones that would always employ the organ more than the other networks, it seemed. Or the soap operas, because there was no money for the soap operas.
Yeah, too bad they didn't use the zither more. Because if you listen to those old Harry Lime radio shows that Orson Welles did.
Absolutely.
Or whatever. That music goes perfect for it.
I think there was a real craze over that guy. Like because
that,
of that
yeah,
movie.
That guy, that thing got played to death at the time, I think.
Do you have the if you have the Criterion Collection DVD, it has a newsreel feature of the guy just playing his zither. So yeah, it is pretty cool. And those I love The Third Man. I mean, you know, my dream book is a book called Foreign Intrigue, and it's just stories like The Third Man all the time.
Yes, I would. That would have my money.
Yeah, there you go, man. You know. God, and we get like Mark Schultz and Gary Gianni and guys like that to draw it. If you know, if money's no object.
Oh, don't talk. And what was it? I saw that. Was it Ryan Sook who did this doing the Commandy thing?
Oh, was he doing it for Wednesday Comics?
Yeah, the Wednesday Comics.
Oh, I bet that's.
And that
be
looked
cool.
Like essentially Mark Schultz, Anton Karas. That's who did the Thurman.
Yes,
thing.
He's the Zither dude. That's right.
And
great guy, of course.
I had my iPod in front of me, so I just went flipping through it.
Oh, you've got the Third Man theme on your iPod. Awesome.
Yeah.
That'd make a good ringtone, actually.
Yes, that answers your question, Mandarin. Okay, you hit a little too close to home.
Exactly.
I guess I pretty much just live and breathe that stuff.
You got us going, man. That's it. That's my wheelhouse, too, so very cool. He also wants to know if Hawkeye, Ronin, is going to die again. Couldn't help but notice that Temujin. I never
Temujin.
Thank you, Temujin is about to punch him in the preview pick.
Well, yeah, and
oh, that's right.
He certainly came away probably coughing up some blood. because he got kicked in the stomach. And
Temujin's Jimmy Woo's lackey in Agents of Atlas. I'm like, who the hell is that? And I'm like, all
well,
right,
as he sees it, he's the true successor to the Atlas Empire.
Yes, yes.
And obviously he did not splatter him into gore, because Jimmy respectfully asked to not kill any of the Avengers. Ronan's so poor, he would be splattered into gore. That was our little theme the other day on Twitter. We were doing Hawkeye so poor tweets.
I know.
I know everybody's going, where the hell did this come from? But then it really caught on. Everybody was into doing the snaps with Hawkeye being so poor.
I saw a couple of the pictures.
And for people who don't know, Hawkeye is Ronan, the Clinton Barton.
Yes.
that came because one of the studio interns, Ben Bates, was asking me that morning about He was looking through a Marvel Adventures Avengers I'd written, and he was saying, well, I don't get with the superheroes. They all live together and then work together out of this. And I said, no, they don't live together. He goes, oh, okay, I thought I saw them at this mansion or the tower or whatever. And I said, no, they just stop by there when they're working. And then I stopped myself and I said, well, Hawkeye probably stays there because he's so broke. And then Steve Lieber came in and started doing snaps with Hawkeye being broke or whatever. And then that's when I mentioned it. And then
It became like...
And Boku Kevin and Chris Sims and everybody just started going nuts on it, because that's exactly the kind of thing that they can do waking up from a stone cold sleep.
So they were doing the dozens on Hawkeye so poor. Hawkeye exactly. So poor that dot, dot, dot. Yeah.
It's like, well, yeah, he's poor. As far as I know, he never had a job. I don't know.
Former carny. Absolutely, man.
He's a former carny. Got it. So poor he was a carny.
Where do you go from, exactly? Where do you go when the carny won't take you anymore? Woof.
That's how poor he was.
Holy shit.
He's so poor he has to change his identity to a different hero every week. I'm Goliath. I'm Ronan. I'm Hawkeye.
Yeah, that's insane. I love Clint Barton, and, you know, yeah, you're right. Let's see. That was good, Mandarin. Thank you. Spidey616 wants to know if there's any chance of Lyra, the new Savage She-Hulk, appearing in a future project of yours once the current mini by the talented Fred Van Lente concludes.
Well, I guess there is. I had no idea that character was going to keep getting used. That was just going to be a one-off story. It was the Hulk Thunder issue where Thunder comes back in time, and we were just kind of playing with the whole notion that Thunder is from this future where there's been, I think Fred finally used a group, what did he call it? Gendercide. I'm probably thinking of Brian Vaughn's book.
Oh, yeah, Why the Last Man.
It's about the same thing. Now, everybody wasn't wiped out, but men and women went to war with each other, which I guess, maybe went in the 70s, that's what it seemed where it seemed like it was going.
Absolutely.
So she's very clearly a child of the 70s. But anyway, so I wrote the story where Thundra comes back and challenges Hulk, and you end up finding out what she's really trying to do is find some genetic material, because the women are they need a new champion to one day succeed her.
Sure.
And you find out, in fact, she wasn't really going back in time to beat male champions, and which is kind of reaching for a reason to travel back in time just to inspire your people.
She was always
trying to find the perfect father to create a daughter who could defeat the enemy.
Sure.
And I originally was just going to they had sex. I didn't show it, but I was, it was going to be strongly implied that they got it on. and then someone at Marvel told me, no, can it be a clone? So I said, so I ended up with she took a sample from his cheek. Yawn. So whatever. It was
meanwhile, Loeb gets to do it in the Ultimates or whatever.
I know. That's not fair.
Man.
But anyway, the whole end is the fact that that future is going to tip over to the women because they had, the best of both worlds.
Sure.
Hulk and Thunder, blah, blah, blah. And then the next thing I know, they're starting to bring her back. They got Paul Tobin writing a story with her, and he did a great job with Benton Jew as the art, who did a story for us in Agents of Atlas.
Yes.
And that was terrific. And then Fred just starts getting ideas like he'll do. And next thing you know, she's got a miniseries. And so, yeah, I guess I will. I guess I will bring her back since she's just going to be here whether I have any say in it or not. So I might as well use her. It's I felt bad, though, because for the longest time I didn't come up with a name for her because I didn't think she was coming back. I wasn't going to bother. It didn't seem a point to mention a name. And then Paul didn't mention a name. So finally Fred names her Lyra. And then when I saw him in New York, I was like, why'd you name her after the little girl from the His Dark Materials book? He's like, oh, God, I guess I did. And he was going with a completely different reference, but he's also a big Philip Pullman fan, so there's no way he wasn't subconsciously thinking about it. It's a good name.
It's a fine name. No, yeah. I think it's cool. I had no idea about the backstory. That's excellent, man. Very interesting. Tachizi, Mr. Parker, ever since the first Agents of Atlas series you wrote back in 2006, Marvel has taken steps towards establishing legacies for some of its characters stretching back for decades. Ghost Rider and Iron Fist come to mind. In addition, there was the 12, as well as the upcoming Marvel's project. In light of this, I'm wondering if you have any plans to incorporate flashbacks using these older characters, such as Orson Randall in Agents of Atlas, or to use some of the 12 in the present day, and finally, if the agents will make an appearance in the Marvel's project.
As far as I know, they're not in the Marvel's project, but you know, the one that seems the most natural to me would be Orson Randall. Even though I don't have a plan to do it at the moment, you'd be surprised how many things come about at the last minute, and then I'm suddenly writing it. So that would probably be the most natural way to go to use him. I like, and there's also some other stuff that Brew and Fraction did that actually lines up really nicely with what I've been doing in Agents of Atlas. So so yes, that very well could happen.
At this point, we had been talking for hours, and the real world intervened, so Jeff had to go. And then I got sick, so several weeks passed before we were able to wrap things up. In the meantime, another issue of Agents of Atlas came out, and a couple more issues of Exiles, much to my surprise. But we were able to catch up and talk more about Jeff's books. So let's jump back into the conversation several weeks later. So I think in the interim, Jeff, I'm happy to say that I was able to grab Exiles, number one. Uh-huh. And you gave a brief description of the team, but now since reading it, and I'm at the end, and it's been a couple weeks now, so I think it's okay to possibly spoil their first mission, at least the general strands of it. They've got to kill Magneto in a world where the X-Men seem to be on his side, and as he pulls up in a parade, adorning the float, seems to be the torso of Wolverine.
You know, nothing really goes on a parade float like Wolverine's head. I think they could get that Thanksgiving Day parade down with a Wolverine head. It would really take off and catch back on again.
You know, this is my first time reading Exiles because, not being the biggest X-Men fan, I know I've heard I've missed a lot of good runs. What is it that appealed to you about doing this book?
I liked the idea. Well, Mark Panichia put it to me that I could go nuts with some of the crazy sci-fi things I like to do that I necessarily can't always do in the Marvel Universe because it affects continuity. Mm-hmm. And since they're floating around outside the main Marvel world most of the time, you know, that gives me license to go big. And I'm not doing it at first because I feel like it's important to establish, before jumping right into wackiness, I want everybody to know the characters, and I want them to know what we're branching away from when we do it. You know, so I'm trying to. That's generally a path I always follow with stories. I like to bring people in at a where something just seems a little odd or whatever, and then by the third act, you know, things just start blowing up out of control. So, and that's kind of the way I'm going with this. I'm trying to drop little odd things here and there, make you just wonder what's up, and eventually, you know, people will be wanting my head on a pike when they see where I was trying to take it all along.
Now, is this group, I mean, I don't want to, you know, obviously we're just starting the first adventure, but is this the set group? Are there going to be switches in and out, or?
And that's the other thing. I don't want to, everybody immediately, I noticed, started predicting, who's going to die first? And I'm like, I'm not going to. I don't want
to. Yeah, I don't want you to spoil that.
I don't want to make it all about that. I want to. There's other things you can take advantage of when you're free from the continuity restraints, such as you can have a character transform a whole lot more than you normally could.
Interesting.
You know, it doesn't always have to be. I'm trying to get away. I'm not saying somebody won't die, but I just think in the past few years at both the big companies, too much has been placed on whether someone dies or not,
mm-hmm.
and it's just turned it into a horse race, and then it limits your imagination because suddenly, you know, you can't think in terms of a big storyline or event without it eventually coming to whether someone's dead or reborn. And there are more than those two things that can happen in a story.
Sure.
You know? So, yeah, I want to really kind of lead people away from worrying about who's dying and what.
Okay.
Except for Wolverine, who will always die every time he appears.
He's Kenny. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, and also, and again, because I am totally coming to X-Files fresh, and I know X-Men fans are laughing their asses off, going, you idiot! But I'll ask anyway. Is the team normally plucked from that moment right before they're going to die, or is that a conceit for this new...
No, that's something we just started.
Okay.
And that was a tip of the hat to the Sound of Thunder, the Ray Bradbury story.
Absolutely.
Because before, I think the original process was they were plucked out of their realities, called Unhinged from Time, and then they were promised that they might get to return one day if they keep up their work and everything. And I felt like, you know, I needed something, a simpler mechanism, but that was kind of already done. And then I thought, no, let's do the Sound of Thunder thing, because if it makes sense that they're taken out at the last minute right before they were going to die. They can't go back in. You understand more that time has already progressed and you're going to mess with your universe. It just won't work to put them back in. So you might as well, you know, if you were suddenly given a second chance at life or whatever, even though you didn't necessarily want it, well, you might as well go along with the people. Or because Oblivion's your other alternative, and, you know, just like they say about aging, it beats the alternative.
Well, I would also imagine the possibility might be there, too, for someone that's plucked out right before they go into a death situation to be a little unhinged from that, and that the experiences they might have might cause them to spin out of control.
Yeah, they can certainly be weirded out.
Yeah.
And they can also be, no matter what they're told about by the time broker, who was Morph from the original team, you know, no matter what they're told, you know a few of them are holding out hope. I bet I can get back. Because like, who wouldn't be?
Sure. Well, yeah, it looks like...
If you jump from universe to universe, you're going to assume, I bet I could get back if I just play my cards right.
Well, and especially, you know, you look at Forge, clearly having a relationship with Storm. And
he wants to get back. He wants to get back to Storm. There's no getting around it. He's not talking about it. He's certainly thinking about it.
Sure. And Wanda had a very interesting point, too, because it's interesting to see a potentially sane Wanda, but then again, she was trying to resurrect Pietro, so...
You wonder how sane she might have been.
Sure. Very cool. No, that's
Wanda
great,
crazy
man.
In every reality? I don't know.
And again, having been able to read it now, I like Kid Panther, too.
Yeah, we already showed that he's the son of T'Challa,
mm-hmm.
named T'Chaka after his grandfather. And it was just fun, the idea of doing a Panther who was more happy-go-lucky. Because Panther's always been such a stoic character.
Absolutely,
His whole existence. So it was a lot of. It's fun making him the one who can, essentially, as people always refer to it, make him the Spider-Man. You know, where he gets to crack and whatever, and not necessarily have to be the rock of the team.
No, that's very cool. I like that a lot.
It plays against type.
So, no, that sounds like a fun team, man. Well, like, all right, I'm at least one issue behind, so I'm going to have to hunt around for two, and three comes out, you say, Wednesday, huh?
Yeah.
Very cool. Excellent.
That and the Agents of Atlas, where they go to see Namor.
Oh, fantastic. Man, this is going to be a busy week. Excellent, man.
It's weird, because now, you know, if you go by the, it's like, wow, Atlas comes out every 2 weeks now. it'll stop, but then you'll have another month like that where it seems to do that. But that's just the way they ordered the series. They said, what do you want? I guess we hit a good time. What do you want, 14, something like that? Yeah, we're just taking whatever we'll get.
That's very interesting. I had no idea it was on that kind of 14-a-year schedule.
Well, you know, you'll see some series, and it's like they'll come out just like every 3 weeks. And you go, well, why does that one come out so much? You know, it just depends. Whatever the number crunchers decide that something can sell.
Wow. That's really, well, then I'm even more impressed that Marvel really got behind you on Agents of Atlas. It really seems like full tilt.
Pretty darn good.
Yeah.
I can't complain. It's funny because now we've had a break since the first part of this interview.
Yes.
Before I was like, okay, I'm a little worried about the Captain Britain thing because people from the first moment that was rumored started abandoning the book, and then it actually did get canceled. But now I'm starting to see a little bit of a turnaround where I'm thinking some people are saying, okay, we lost Captain Britain, darn it, don't let this book start sliding down into the 20s where it would get in danger. So hopefully people rally a little bit more. It's a weird way of thinking. You know, I tend to expect stuff I like that I really get into is always going to be, just like movies, just like music, is never going to be the top of the charts thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't look at it as a thing, well, that's not going to be around that long. You know, I just get as much of it as I can while I can, and then go around, run around getting bootlegs and whatever else there
sure.
is related to it. And I'm surprised when comics people don't do that. And I think it's the collector's habit still stuck on people. And, you know, they still think in terms of, I want a complete run of this, and then if it runs out, what's the value? Even though they never actually sell their comics. You know, they're thinking in terms of value and whatever Overstreet used to say. And stuff like that, which is, as we were talking about, when there's a reading device, if there is, that's going to go away then. There shouldn't be comic collecting anymore, as you understood it. And I could care less, because I was never a collector, I was a reader.
I agree.
And I hope, and I don't feel like I'm slamming any of my fans, because just like I don't like calling them fans usually, because I usually like to say readers, because
sure.
I think they're readers. And when I talk to them at shows, they all... You know, I'll ask them what other books they read, like just prose stuff, and they always read good stuff. And it always makes me feel really good. It's like, oh, good, I've got a smart bunch here.
No,
they could be a little more rabid, but, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, I was telling you off the air that I've started to do videos, and I've got a YouTube channel set up, and did an interview with Tim Seeley at a comic book store, and mm-hmm. you will very prominently see in the background an Agents of Atlas poster.
Ah, good.
So product placement.
Good positioning of Tim Seeley.
How about that, man? Isn't that funny?
That is the perfect placement of Tim Seeley. Put him in front of some posters.
Now, another series that's up and running as we record, I want to say this came out last week, Dark Reign the Hood.
Yes, that also just came out.
Excellent. And now, you know, I hate the continuity question, but... Obviously, there's a new Avengers component that involves the Hood right now, as Doctor Strange is... everyone's trying to figure out who the next Sorcerer Supreme is going to be. The Hood figures very prominently in that. Is this story concurrent? Is it before? Is it after?
It's a little bit before.
Okay.
It's just we couldn't... Once they approved the villain series or whatever, there was no getting it out any faster. You know, we jumped right on it as soon as we could.
Sure.
And you know, I was really happy that Kyle Hoetz could do it. It's like, oh, great, it'll look right, too. Cause
yeah, the original artist.
Yeah, it's the original creator. And so, you know, I made a choice. It's like, we'll back it up and give them a lot of stuff that they can read, and it'll add to the experience of reading what you're reading at the time. So yeah, it should fill in a lot, and for people who've been missing the whole thing of Parker Robbins' backstory and what's going on with his girlfriend and baby and mother and all that, we get all into that.
Okay. And his
from what I know of what's coming up in New Avengers, it should really set that stuff up well if you read it in that order, you know.
If you read The Hood first and then read New Avengers.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's but that's for trade waiters, you know. Yeah, read whichever you're going to get at the store, but Get them all.
Well, he's one of the main players of the Cabal.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this is one of Norman's men, yet as even before Secret Invasion, had already kind of slipped in to take the Kingpin's place to a degree as a crime lord. And
yeah, Bendis wasted no time pushing him up the ladder. I thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah, well, and a lot of
people... It makes it for an interesting... You know, it makes one of those good Corleone climb to the top sort of things. And we certainly riff on Godfather and Sopranos in the miniseries too.
Yeah, you can feel that vibe, absolutely.
Yeah, you get more into it in issue two, but we really play up the whole, and it's fun because then instead of like Big Pussy, it's you know, it's like the Living Laser or something like that who's hanging around, but yet you still get the same vibe, and I you know, that's a lot of fun to write.
I hear things. Yeah. I'm a Living Laser. Like a De Niro playing Living Laser. I like that. I don't know.
Funny ha-ha.
Exactly. The absorbing man goes Pesci on somebody. Although I guess Frank Thierry, I was reading today, has his set of bad guys. Is that something that was decided editorially? I mean, because I know Frank's got his kind of group of books as well.
Mm-hmm.
Of bad guys. It's Made Men and I can't remember the other
Lethal
name.
Legion,
Lethal Legion, thank you. Yeah. So, yeah, was it like, okay, these guys are up for grabs, let's get some books around them too while this is all good, while the bad guys are kind of in charge?
I wasn't at the meeting where they jumped on this, but it caught fire once whoever brought it up. And, you know, they wanted to make the most of it. And of course, that's the way it would be going. It's just like, Osborne's in charge, sure, everybody's going to be not afraid to show their heads and you know, one of the things I like, though, is I think you're getting some better rounded pictures of the villains. And we can maybe get away from calling them villains. Because they're just more interesting if they've got their own points other than simply, must kill Spider-Man.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, when they've got their own story going, I always like Crusher Creel. He's great.
Yep.
I just love the idea of a chain gang convict who's really got it in for the God of Thunder. You know, just the idea that this guy, well, here's the Nordic God of Thunder, and here's this Hoboken guy who's on a chain gang.
You know what pisses me off?
They're natural enemies. I think the ancient saga writers often anticipated a Crusher Creel one day coming from an undiscovered land. In Njal's saga, I think there's a little bit of it.
But he does kind of have that Minotaur kind of... I mean, he doesn't have, you know, he's not half bull or anything, but it's certainly his attitude.
Kirby could just create a myth out of nothing. I swear, he could just take something and bam, he just had a mythic... Paul Tobin said it perfectly one day at the studio, where he said, you can't touch Kirby if he's on gods and simpletons. You know, if you get Moon Boy or a Celestial, it's just, bam, you might as well not even try to go there because you're not going to keep up with it.
Now, I didn't know...
said something other than Simpleton. I can't remember what it was.
I didn't know that Tobin was part of the Mercury Studio.
Yeah, he joined not too long ago.
Very cool.
He was kind of hanging at home, working, and then he kept asking me, he's like, how are you getting work done up there, writing? And of course, I would not hear him because I'm tuning everybody out, and I'd look up and say, huh? And then he started to realize he could do that, too. And he's gotten that way where I've noticed him over in his section. He'll get in his own world or whatever and tune everybody out, and you can do it.
Give me the rundown of who's in the studio, then, on a given day.
Oh, gosh, I'm going to screw up and miss somebody. Let's see. I'm going to try to work around the room. Okay, and when you walk in the main room, if you look to your left, there's Dustin Weaver, who's a relatively new member, even though he's now been with us probably almost a year. Dustin's doing some great stuff on, he's drawing the X-Men Legacy, Mike Carey's writing.
Oh, wow, okay.
Over next to him in the corner is Matthew Clark, though he really works at home more than anything. Going next, there's Ron Chan, who's a young artist, came out of the Savannah College of Art and Design, and worked with me on a bit of the Guy Ritchie gamekeeper thing when I did the story after Andy Diggle.
Excellent.
Let's see, then Jonathan Case, who you don't know yet, but he's going to eventually eclipse us all. He's been working on this personal work called Sea Freak about this poetic souled sea monster that I can't describe it, but it's really great. And then you work up to, let's see, stopping right there with her desk position at the side is Dylan McConus, who does a lot of web strips like Bite Me. Yeah, it was a vampire thing.
Sure.
And she doesn't like Twilight.
Good for her. I already like her.
Yeah. You're in the club. Yeah, I wonder if NPR will let me go on and give a counter to Brad Meltzer's I Like Twilight. Of course, I don't think you need more people coming on piling I Hate Twilight.
Yeah, really.
But let's see. And then in the corner, we got Ron Randall, who people have been reading ever since Trekker. In any number of Dark Horse books, have seen Ron's work. And
mm-hmm.
Ron was recently working on Supergirl, and he's done Wonder Woman stuff. I'm hoping to suck him into some Marvel stuff coming up.
Very cool.
Let's see. We got in the little middle section, we have sometimes Carl Kiesel, who everybody knows.
Yep.
Kat Ellis, who's another one of the new SCAD kids. Well, she's not that new. She's been around forever to us, but she'd be new to other people.
She's a big studio.
Very, very talented if you look on her website. And go over to Steve Lieber, who is now mainly known for Whiteout, even though he did lots of stuff since Hawkman.
Sure.
For DC for years. Not too long ago did some of Thunderbolts and mm-hmm. the Frontline thing at Marvel, and is working on something with me that we're in another month going to be just blabbing about nonstop.
Okay.
So, Terry Nelson, who does a lot of print type stuff, she doesn't do comics, so everybody will go, huh, who's that?
Okay.
Next across from her is Jesse Hamm, who drew Good as Lily. It worked with Derek Kirk Kim.
Oh wow.
And very talented artist. Okay, then finally you get to me. I'm across from the kitchenette, and everybody sits their damn dirty dishes all over my bookshelf or whatever. It's like I try to keep it clean, but, okay, I don't try to keep it clean. But they still don't have to set food all over it. So I'm sitting there, I'm in the corner because I'm trying to, like, that was my little concession to try to be quiet. Like, I'll be back here. I won't get sucked into as many conversations. Then right in front of me is Colleen Coover. So mainly I talk to Colleen all day. Is pretty much the way that works out. Colleen's working on more stuff. She just did a Pet Avengers story and is working on another thing like that for Marvel. It's been really cool watching her just become the Marvel girl all along. And, of course, she's married to Paul Tobin, but he's on the other side of the room. Then there's Rich Ellis, who just did a short coming up in a Fantastic Four special with Paul. And he's done two of the Twilight Zone books that I think only one's come out so far.
I've heard about those. I haven't seen them yet.
Yeah, he illustrated the, what's the one that had Claude Akins in it, where there, something on Main Street?
Now yeah, the Monsters Are Due on Main Street?
Monsters Due on Main Street, yeah. So he drew that. And then next to him is David Hahn, who a lot of people know from Bite Club.
Mm-hmm.
And Fables, and at the moment, what is Dave working on? He's working on, like, two things at once. And he's done a lot of Marvel Adventures Fantastic Four, too, recently.
Cool.
Okay, I'm forgetting what Dave's working on right now. He'll appreciate that.
Do they all listen?
Going past to him is Paul Guinan, who's been working on this. He's the one who created the boilerplate hoax, that he wasn't really trying to make a hoax about the Victorian-era robot. And he's just completed a huge coffee table book that will be coming out soon. It all kind of grew out of when Chris Elliott ended up using boilerplate as a character in his book a couple of years ago. Well, actually, it's been like 4 years ago or whatever, because Chris didn't bother to fact-check and see that there weren't actually robots in the Victorian era. And that is... Chris of Letterman.
Get a Life and David Letterman. And...
Yeah. Not. Now I can't remember the other guy's name. Is it Sam and Ray?
Oh, Bob and Ray.
Bob and Ray.
Yeah, but that's like for you, me, and Jeff Loeb.
Yeah, that, maybe yeah, what Bendis. Am I thinking? Like, no one's going to know what I'm talking
maybe
about.
Bendis, anyway, maybe Rucka.
His dad, yeah, maybe Rucka, maybe not. His dad used to be in radio.
Absolutely. Bob Elliott, who was the security guard in the Bill Murray film Quick Change, where he's the clown that's robbing the bank.
That's right.
For people who might know their comedy, and you might know Bob from that. And, of course, he played Chris's dad on Get a Life as well.
Exactly.
So.
And everybody's like, what's Get a Life? It was funny.
Oh, that was a great show, man.
It was. And let's see, I think that leaves the last one where Aaron McConnell, who's recently did a whole adaptation of The Constitution that came out from one of the bigger book publishers, and now I don't remember which one.
He did like a comic version of The Constitution?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it really does a good job of explaining a lot of stuff. Because comics, perfect for...
Well, you know, I think we did good, Jeff. I think we've tangented along in a lot of ways in this conversation.
Did nothing if not tangent along.
Absolutely,
that's pretty much all we did.
Anything else to tease about the hood? I don't want to cut you short on that because.
Let's see.
We went off on our merry way. Anything to say about some of the regular characters that are in it? Madam Mask.
Oh yeah. Well, Madam Mask continues to get naked. For somebody who doesn't take that mask off, she takes that mask off quite a bit. And I believe I saw Bendis just had her whipping that mask off again the other day. And New Avengers. She can't wait to pop that thing off. Well, because you know what the secret is underneath the mask.
No.
She's hot. No. But you weren't expecting it to go there, were you?
I liked her seduction scene with the Sheik in exile, or he's going back to the old country, but he's kind of a hedonist as well. And
yeah, I saw one person complain that's like that I was using an Arab stereotype, and I was like, no, I'm using a Sheik stereotype. He's not just some devout Muslim or something. He's a good for nothing Sheik. They're not. I mean, these are the model of excess. Come on. Now.
Absolutely.
Give
me
a break on the.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the oppressors get to be made fun of. I would say, yeah,
same,
absolutely.
Same thing as if I were doing some American guy with a Boss Hog suit. You know, it's like,
Yeah, this is a corrupt
Southern guy.
Yeah, this is a corrupt senator or something like that. I mean, if you want to put it in American terms, big deal.
Yeah, but it's more, it is more colorful because it's a chic. And
sure.
You get to have cool robes and stuff like that and everything.
No, it's very cool, man. Good start to it, and it's a 5-issue miniseries?
Yes.
Excellent.
And in fact, thanks for reminding me about it, because Michael Horowitz, the assistant editor, was just emailing me asking me if I had some notes to put in for changes for the letterer tomorrow, and I was like, oh yeah, I still need to do that.
Okay.
Sometimes I wander off into the backyard when people are asking for those things, and they need that in.
No, it's as always, man. It's a pleasure talking to you. And hey, I'm entering my fifth year of Word Balloon. I just had last month my millionth download.
Oh my gosh!
And I know I was stunned as well. And it all started with four interviews, and it was Mark Andreyko, Brian Azzarello.
I remember this too. I remember there were only three other things besides my interview on there.
Brian Azzarello, Max Collins.
Oh, okay.
And Mark Andreyko and you.
Yeah.
You were the four. There we go.
The only non-M name. That was me.
And it was because of the internet.
Yeah.
So.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, look how far. And, I mean, I'm thrilled that, bigger opportunities have come and a bigger spotlight for you and more readers are becoming aware of your work. And that's great. And I think you're doing a great job. And I'm really happy about Agents of Atlas getting the opportunity that it is with 14 issues this year. Excellent series, and, whether there would be an event going on or not, I just think a really interesting group of characters, and it looks like you're doing the same for Exiles.
And you'll like coming up to, did I mention this before when we were talking? Probably not, because I just wrote it, but I'm working back in. Did you read the little in-between text pages in the original series?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. I'm bringing back Shore to Shore AM, the late night radio show hosted by Webb Terry. If you remember what that was,
Yes.
Yeah, it's like I found a good way to work it back in, and by God, I'm going to campaign until I'm on coast to coast talking to George Norrie. So you just think of anything you want me to say while I'm on there.
Okay.
That coast to coast is a perennial favorite of, or at least it used to be until everybody could get podcasts and listen at any time they wanted. But for all the artists, like especially I remember my buddy Casey Jones, who was drawing some upcoming Exile stories.
Okay.
Or whatever. He and I used to both listen to it because he would be up working late at night. It was always that or Loveline. We'd listen to Loveline, and then talk about it or something in email, or listen to Coast to Coast because that was what was on when you were up at 3 in the morning.
Sure.
And what's better when you're drawing comics than a bunch of stuff about ghosts and UFOs all the time? Art Bell and his wacky escapades.
Yeah, it just blew my mind when Art Bell walked away, and I think George does a fine job. But yeah, no, I don't think you have to be an artist to appreciate that show. I think any third shift person or just night owls and stuff were definitely into that show because it's just so crazy.
Yeah, it's like you finally have an answer. Where do you get your ideas? Well, duh, AM 77. Yeah. Coast to coast AM.
Jesus. Well, there you go.
From the broadcasting from the high desert.
Well, I hope someone gets this to George Norrie and they can hear how he's got a couple fans in the podcast world there. That'd be good. When you make your announcement next month, hopefully I'll get you and Lieber on to talk about whatever you got coming up.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Get us both on.
That'd be great.
All right, John. Talk to you later.
From his corner of the Marvel Universe, that's Jeff Parker. Make sure you check out those books. Exiles, the Hood miniseries, Agents of Atlas, and from Wildstorm, Mysterious, the Unfathomable. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress reminding you that Word Balloon is all over the internet. Come to our website, wordballoon.com. You'll find our archive of well over 200 interviews with comic creators and also people from television and film. We're, of course, at newsarama.com. You can find us on iTunes if you search for under Word Balloon. And you can follow me online. I'm at Facebook under my name, John Suntress, at Twitter as John Word Balloon. And, of course, there's our own forum at jinxworld.com, also accessible at our website, wordballoon.com, where you can ask me any question you want and even start some threads for future guests and get your input just like on this program with Jeff. You can also email any questions or comments about the show, john@wordballoon.com. So thanks for listening. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2009.